Hi, this is Jim.
And this is Max.
Check out our podcast, The Step Over, Liberty Ballers Podcast Network, for all of your Sixers needs.
Player analysis, game breakdowns, who would look coolest in a headband, and more.
Subscribe to Liberty Ballers Podcast feed on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts, and check out The Step Over, a podcast about Sixers basketball.
Mostly.
It's out of here! Home run, Lenny Dykstra!
Stairs rips one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
The Phillies win the game on a base hit by Mitch Williams at 4:40 in the morning.
Swing and a miss, struck him out. It's wacky, wonderful. Bunch of throwbacks has won the National League pennant.
It's continued success time again. Hooray for you, the listener, with this happening in your ears. You were just trying to listen to regular podcasts, but now we're here. It's me, Justin Clue, the managing editor of The Good Fight, along with Liz Rocher, the former managing editor of The Good Fight and full-time contributor to Yahoo Sports. We talk about the Phillies here, and because the regular season Phillies are over, we do even more of what we were doing during the regular season, which is chronicling the 2008 and 1993 Phillies seasons, because that's fun. And in some ways, it's more fun than the current goings-on in the MLB postseason, which is stricken with its typical drama and silliness and Joe West, and it's terrific.
It's great. But it's the best thing. Are you kidding me? It's not happening to the Phillies. I'm sorry. We're talking about this for a second. It's not happening to the Phillies. So this is all so fun.
We focus only on the simple things in life. So with that in mind, Liz, was it a home run or not?
I actually don't know.
Nobody knows.
People say they know. Nonsense. They're lying.
They don't know. Nobody knows. Look, I think this more than anything, the whole what we're of course talking about is what happened last night in the NLCS when it was like the first inning, right?
Yeah.
Jose Altuve, ball, home run. That Mookie Betts looked like he was going to make an incredible catch on, but then a fan reached in and jostled the glove. And so it was like clearly a home run, but also probably a catch. Did they call it fan interference?
Yes. Well, and the big issue is that, you know, did the player reach, were the fans reaching outside, you know, into the field of play? Because the rules are pretty clear, you know, and I think that the interference call was made not necessarily based on the rule, but based on the fact that Mookie Betts' glove was fucked with. I think that's really why. I think that's it. I think that's a defendable reason, but I also think maybe instead of just calling it out, recognizing the gray area of the situation and calling it just a double would have been fair.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, but at the end of the day, it's like you've been saying all day that there is still, you can try to control baseball, you can try to put baseball on a clock, but at the end of the day, that human element's coming through in some way or another, and the playoffs always seem to find a way to put it front and center, and that certainly did last night. And so much of the drama in this postseason, I feel, is based on reputations and like how the people want to give Manny Machado the benefit of the doubt when he ran into quote unquote Jesus Aguilar's leg. No, he didn't. Look at his behavior. You want to give people want to give Joe West a pat on the back for making the right call on that home run. Yeah, but Joe West is Joe West. The only thing Joe West got out of that wasn't like the satisfaction of making the right call. It was, yay, I'm at the center of attention again. So there's just a lot of that in this playoffs, and I can't believe there's still an entire World Series left to play.
Oh, God, there really is.
And don't forget, Liz, there's much, much more baseball to come. So with that in mind, here on Continued Success, we have last week we focused on the first half of the 1993 NLCS. And that makes you, of course, wonder how slowly are they really going to go because they're going to run out of time. And that's an excellent point. So today we're going to be covering the 2008 NLCS. In its entirety, a series that I'm sure everyone remembers with the utmost clarity, because I think that's probably in the wheelhouse of most of our listeners. This was a series that Liz, you and I both have been looking forward to talking about.
Yes.
It was a series that I think a lot of people thought I guess the Dodgers were favored because they had acquired Manny Ramirez. That was a big part of the narrative going into this series. But I don't think either team was favored very heavily.
No, I don't think so, from my memory. I think it was supposed to be a series that lasted longer than it did.
I think that's very accurate. Yeah, this series only lasting five games was, it was a relief to us watching at home.
But a surprise to everybody.
A surprise and a relief. But yeah, I certainly remember the end of this series, which I was watching in an apartment on North Broad Street in Philadelphia. And I ran down to Broad Street, and it was just one of those rare moments where the entire city operated as a single unit instead of like a couple hundred thousand furious, miserable people. We were all one joyous unit together, and I was just standing alongside the street, like pumping my fist and cheering as cars went by and everybody honked. Like everybody knew what was, you know, what everyone was talking about. There was no question. It wasn't like any day of the week I could have been down there doing that and people would have been like, oh, that's a crazy person who's escaped. But no, in this case it was, yeah, no, that's, I know what that guy's doing because I'm excited about the same thing. And it was just a wonderful little Philadelphia moment brought about by the least likely source of joy in the Philadelphia area, a sports team. So we'll talk about this series, which was a lot of fun. We'll start with game one, which Liz, I'm going to let you open things up here. But yeah, things were, I feel like winning that NLDS, I said when we talked about the NLDS that Shane Victorino hitting that grand slam off CC Sabathia kind of, and this is might be a lot of hindsight, but solidified in my mind that this team was going to do more than at least, you know, get dropped out of the first round of the playoffs like they had the last year. This was a team that was ready to do more damage than that. And, you know, they kind of proved that with game one.
Yes, they certainly did. I mean, the thing that separates most playoff teams from other playoff teams or other teams is timely hitting. And that's what the Phillies had in this series. I don't think you're wrong that it sort of started like Shane Victorino did his thing and everyone's like, oh, so that's who this team is. Well, it'll be interesting. And it really was. I mean, game one, it was Cole Hamels versus Derek Lowe. Derek Lowe would start game four. Derek Lowe is a name that is going to, you'll be seeing on your Hall of Fame ballot this year, your Hall of Fame ballot, the Hall of Fame ballots of other people that they deign to share online.
That is a mean joke, Liz. Really mean, mean-spirited, low. That is a real low point for this podcast.
Yes, but yeah, Derek Lowe.
Go
should
to bring hell, back- everyone.
Derek Lowe should bring back some memories. This was, and Cole Hamels also. In his
couple.
Watching him, he's a baby. He's a fetus person. He's just like, I mean, we're nearly the same age. I'm just like, that is, I looked as young as he did 10 years ago.
Watching some of these Phillies in clips from 10 years ago, you're just like, is he okay out there? Is he all right? I don't even mean like injured. Like, is he lost? Yeah. Does he need a hand? Does he want me to hold his hand while he crosses the street? I can help you.
Yes. But the Phillies won game one, 3-2. But Manny Ramirez sort of made himself known super duper early. It was a double that was almost very nearly a home run that gave Los Angeles the lead early on. And that affected how the Phillies treated him for the rest of the series. I have a fun moment to talk about in early game four that I think will tickle everybody pink.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And I remember Joe Buck's commentary on that and being like, what in the goddamn hell? Yeah, but that's,
yes.
You're absolutely right. This is that was such a not interesting, I guess, appropriate moment that like the way this series starts out is by him doing that. I mean, it tells you how great of a player we were watching when we watched Manny Ramirez. And I remember being really irritated by him as a baseball fan, all worked up, full of piss and vinegar in my early 20s. And Manny Ramirez really got under my skin. But if he was on the Phillies, obviously, you know, I would have been his number one fan. And on top of being that sort of player, he was also just an incredible hitter and a huge difference maker. And that's why they hung a Manny Wood sign in LA when they acquired him. And he made a huge difference on that team. And that's why they brought him in to make an immediate impact in a playoff series. And he did off the Phillies' best starting pitcher. So that was unnerving, to say the least.
Exactly. I love watching him. He's Manny, and I'm torn on whether he should be in the Hall of Fame. It's a question that I ask myself every year, and I still don't know. But I just, you know, he should be remembered for how good he was and how frustrating he was to face, because, you know, the Dodgers lost the series, but he was great in it.
Did you know in August of 2008, Manny Ramirez played in 29 games and he hit .415 in 29
games. My God.
With 18 walks still. Like, his OPS was 1244. He had a monthly OPS over 1,000 in 4 of the 6 months of the regular season baseball season.
Jeez. You don't see that now.
No, what a monster.
I mean, there are great players, but like that's otherworldly. That's unimaginable.
Yeah.
Unimaginable. To wrap up game one, the Phillies scored all their runs in one inning, the sixth. It featured a throwing error and then a home run to Chase, and then a home run by Chase Sutley, and then a Pat Burrell home run. They were up 3-2, and that was the end.
Yeah.
Brad Lidge got the save, and that was it.
I got to say, I had this written down for another game, but seeing that it happened in this game too, we can just talk about it now. There are not a ton of connections between 1993 and 2008, the two teams we talk about on this podcast. But between the 1993 and 2008 NLCS, one of the only ones is the fact that Greg Maddux pitched in this game for the Dodgers, while also obviously pitching for the Braves in 1993. That's one of the few links. The others I wrote down, I there could be more, but the others I wrote down were that Larry Boa was the third base coach of the Dodgers.
I have that written down in my notes. Yeah, because he was in game four. I have Larry Boa, third base coach with Dodgers, !
You know who the first base coach was?
Who?
Mariano Duncan, who was on 1993.
Oh, God, you're right.
Yeah, and he played a key role in a bench clearing almost brawl later on in the series. But I also wrote down Tim McCarver, because it is funny to be watching clips of both of these series, and it's just Tim McCarver with two different play-by-play announcers, and it's just like you can rotate that wheel, man. Life goes by, but Tim McCarver, he was eternal. He didn't leave that booth. Your opinion on him is what it was, but he wasn't going anywhere. I think he was just connected to that chair. But Chan Ho Park actually came in to relieve Derek Lowe. So future or former Philly,
yes.
Chan Ho Park. But yeah, Blake DeWitt made that error, I believe. He was playing shortstop for the Dodgers. Or no, that was Rafael Furcal. Blake DeWitt was at second. But the Dodgers had a brutal series error-wise. They did not play solid defense, and especially – they also really struggled with runners hitting with runners in scoring position, and Blake DeWitt and Furcal also were particularly bad in those two areas. But in game two, Phillies again compressed their scoring into, in this case, just two innings, but they were 2 4-run innings. And man, if you got a team that can do that, I was going to say, and put a playoff pitcher on the mound, then yeah, you're going to be a really effective team in the playoffs. One of the defining characteristics of this team that always gets brought up is that Cole Hamels was a great pitcher. And then beyond that, you kind of were just rolling the dice. Brett Myers, Jamie Moyer, Joe Blanton pitched in this series. You know,
how the hell did they win a World Series? They put together a rotation with four of the best pitchers who were pitching in baseball at the time in 2011 and couldn't do it. Yet they had Cole Hamels and four scrubs.
Yeah. Joe Blanton was a huge midseason pickup. Instead of Manny Ramirez, they acquired Joe Blanton in the middle of the
season. He did it for him, though.
And he did it. And yeah, we can't argue that. But would you argue if baseball was like, look, we went over the numbers and that's just an inappropriate rotation, and we're gonna take the World Series away from the Phillies for having such a crappy rotation back then? I would be like, yeah, I mean, that makes sense.
That's can't disagree with you.
I was just hoping you wouldn't discover that this entire time.
No, we've all been quiet about it for a decade now. It's too late now, right? You can't take it away.
What took you so long, frankly?
we all think you're stupid.
So it was Brett Myers who got the ball in game two. But the Dodgers kind of had a similar thing going on where their rotation, And I'm not looking at the numbers. I don't know how they had clearly an impactful enough of a rotation to make the playoffs. A young Clayton Kershaw was on this team, but certainly he was not starting for this team.
No, he came in relief in game four, though.
Yeah, he came in to pitch in relief. Poor little.
He is a baddie.
Sweet little Clayton Kershaw. But the Dodgers starting rotation was Derek Lowe, Chad Billingsley, and all the rest, because they went back to Derek Lowe in game four. But Chad Billingsley got pitched for the Dodgers in game two, and the Phillies feasted on him for the first of two times in this series. Brett Myers, he did fine. He gave up enough runs for the Phillies to lose, but he had an offense that backed him up with more runs than the other team scored. So he wasn't really
Hiroki Kuroda.
Kuroda, right, because he battled with Shane Victorino. And we are just itching to get to these later games in this series.
I know, hurry up. I don't want this
all
is boring.
Stuff happened. Yeah.
Phillies scored a bunch of runs. Done.
Phillies beat up on Chad Billingsley. He was terrible. Carlos Ruiz double. This was in the second inning with two outs. They strung together one, two, three, four, five hits in a row and then a walk before Chad Billingsley finally struck out Ryan Howard. And they were all singles except Chooch hit a double. They put up a 4-1 lead at that point. Brett Myers gave up another home run the next inning to James Loney. But then it was a Brett Myers RBI single that knocked in the Phillies' next two runs the following inning with the bases loaded. And then Shane Victorino hit a triple that scored two more runs with two outs. So after that, the Phillies were up 8-2. Manny Ramirez hit a three-run bomb the following inning because his presence was never not known during this series. That was in the fourth inning. After that, nobody scored again. Brad Lidge had an interesting top of the ninth. He allowed a leadoff walk to Manny, but, that was going to happen. He walked James Loney as well. So he allowed two base runners, but then, got three swinging strikeouts and got out of the inning. So that was a pretty quintessential 2008 Phillies win. Offense bashes the ball. Starting pitcher goes deep enough. Brad Lidge comes in. I believe Ryan Madsen showed up in this game. Yeah, Myers went five innings. It wasn't great. Chad Durbin, JC Romero had to come in to pick up the pieces. But, like I said, they didn't allow any damage. In fact, between Durbin, Romero, Madsen, and Lidge, the Phillies pitchers after Myers allowed only two hits and three walks and no earned runs. So they kept it uninteresting, which was very, very fortunate, because winning this second game at home before going on the road was another moment where I was like, all right, this is a good team. It's okay to believe in this team. I think every year in the playoffs, we get reminded of how important, and you can talk about momentum and its role in baseball. I'm at the point where I'm in the middle ground of all this kind of stuff, like gut, but also statistics, but also this. You go 2-0, you go up 2-0 and then go on the road. I mean, the Phillies could beat this team. Being in an away park has its advantages, but has its disadvantages. But the Phillies already being up two games, I'm sure, helped them very much mentally. And so winning that second game was crucial. And a lot of that came from just beating the hell out of Chad Billingsley. But onward to game three in Los Angeles, which was the game where, this is where things got pretty squirrely. I'm not sure if you're prepared to talk about this, Liz. I assume you are.
Oh, yeah. I can talk about my favorite moment of the game where you could have blocked out Shane Victorino's head with a black dot and known what he was saying just from the movement of his hands.
Yep. It's so funny. He communicated so well. It was like he was the Fanatic. He communicated so well non-verbally, even though he was also being verbal.
It's like it's like I look at, I'm half Italian. I speak with my hands. I hit people when I talk with them because I'm very expressive. I watch him do that. I'm like, is he signing for the deaf? Does he have an Italian relative? Is this just how he speaks? Is he doing this for the benefit of I just love it because he's like, you're good. Don't throw at my head, throw at my side. I don't think there's any swearing. Cause that should be punctuated with a you dick.
I mean, honestly, maybe you can refresh our memories though. Like, what was the context to this? Like, I know the Dodgers hate hated Shane Victorino after this series. I know he only hit, I believe, like 222 in the NLCS this year. But I think he might have been a notorious Dodger killer. And he was also just an irritating player to play against. Like, he was the Phillies' version of Manny Ramirez. He was the Phillies' version of Jose Reyes, which is, you know, a hint at something else we're going to talk about in a minute, because the Phillies drew that comparison themselves. But yeah, I mean, what was the idea here, that the Phillies threw at somebody else? Or
it started in game two,
right?
I think. Yeah. Because Jamie Moyer,
Russell Martin
in the knee. Yes. And
let me ask a question based on that. Because now I'm completely remembering all this. You get hit by a pitch from Jamie Moyer, a pitcher I once watched throw inside at someone, and while the pitch was on the way, was still able to scream, "Watch out," because he had accidentally thrown too far inside. Not only because he is the nicest man, but also because he's Jamie Moyer. How fast is his fastball? So my question is, you get hit by a pitch by Jamie Moyer. Do you even charge the mound if you are 100% sure that it's on purpose?
I mean, maybe if you're Russell Martin, I'm not sure.
Russell Martin was very worked up and very frustrated this entire
season. He was also an enormous dude. I forgot how giant he was.
I remember thinking of him as like, he's a hothead to watch in the future, but he very much calmed down. He's not known universally in that way. This series, though, he was, I mean, you know, it's the playoffs. I get it. You're worked up, but, and it was very frustrating to lose to this Phillies team. But yeah, that's right. Russell Martin got brushed back by Brett Myers in game two.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry here because I wanted to make sure I had the details right. And apparently Brett Myers nearly hit Russell Martin and threw behind Manny in game two, led to...
But Moyer did hit him with a pitch, perhaps during the regular season. That happened.
Yeah, I mean, it says that he did it in the first inning of this game, and then Clay Condrey nearly hit Martin again. Like, that's three times in two games. I don't think he was being targeted. I just think people sucked. Either that or he was just too big and no one could find the strike zone.
Clay Condrey threw a brushback pitch at Martin in this game. And then Martin stepped out and stared at Condrey, and then he grounded into a double play. And that's when he had his like full on meltdown in the dugout, throwing his bat, throwing his helmet. That's what led to this. So that's what led to when Victorino was batting. Kuroda throws at Victorino's head. Victorino politely informs him of where it is okay to hit someone. I genuinely don't think Victorino would have been offended at being hit in the ribs.
It's part of the game to these guys. I mean, a decade ago is a weirdly long time ago. Like, watching these games it's really a bizarre experience to watch baseball be played this way, because it's so quiet.
At the same time, I also can see Victorino getting hit in the ribs and, you know, having a reaction to that based on the drama of the situation. I mean, also Chad Durbin hit Russell Martin with a pitch again after this. Like, this team hated Russell Martin in a way that I did not recall significantly. Like, that's a lot. That's a lot for one game.
Did he stand? Was he just a close plate stander? Was he a Chase Utley? Who love to stand close to the plate and dare pitchers to hit him.
I guess, but when you say a brushback pitch, that's like you're insinuating heavily that you're doing it on purpose, right? But I guess that's what you do to a guy who stands too close to the plate. But yeah, this is when the bench is cleared. And I'm going to rewind 1 second to the pregame. The Dodgers had a bunch of like their vaunted former infield throw out the first pitch, of which Davey Lopes is a part. And he comes out and, wearing his Phillies uniform, throws one of the four ceremonial first pitches of the game. Is that weird to you?
Yeah, that is weird.
It's weird, right? Okay. That was like, oh, that's weird. I mean, on the one hand, it's like, okay, yeah, this is like a, hey, we all played baseball together kind of moment. But like, asking the first base coach of the opposing team in a tense playoff series to come out and throw the first ceremonial pitch, it's almost like somebody's getting needled, but I'm not really sure who's getting needled in that situation. Like, You didn't write that off as like, yeah, no, it was baseball, blah, blah, blah. You know, let's just see all these guys together again. And he just so happens to be the Phillies coach. But I mean, it's weird. It's just weird optics to see a member of the current other team throwing out a ceremonial first pitch in the other team's stadium. Mm-hmm. That struck me as odd.
I want to keep talking about the benches clearing, because I mean, I think game three is significant for that mostly. I had completely forgot. I have a few notes written down. I had completely forgotten that the broadcast tried to throw to commercial.
Love it. Oh, I love when that happens.
Well, and then Manny Ramirez, who was not involved.
Oh, I have that written down too.
Oh, my God.
Put on the biggest show of needing to be held back.
Like, you can't keep him back. He is so, I mean, it's Manny. This is the Manny game, but he might be acting, mm-hmm. but this just might be who he is. He's just like, is there fighting? There's fighting. Excuse me. I have to go.
I'm involved in this. I'm defending my player. What happened? I was in the bathroom, but what happened? But it doesn't matter. Let me throw my body at the problem.
God. Like, I'm continuing to watch, and Boa and Duncan are now yelling and pointing at the other team for no reason. Oh, because Davey Lopes is... Yeah. Boa and Lopes and Duncan are all just having an old man yell and point contest.
Yeah, Duncan and Boa, who are, I would say, most known for being on the Phillies, but are currently on the Dodgers, and Lopes, who's most known for being on the Dodgers, but currently on the Phillies, and they're all screaming at each other. It's such an incestuous, weird baseball moment.
Well, and it's like, it's just, the three of them are the last ones out on the field, because the Victorino grounded out, and then him and Kuroda had words. And then they sort of moved to each other a little bit and then moved back. But all of a sudden, like, everyone was there. Everyone was there. And the broadcast was trying to throw to commercial. And, you know, they couldn't because there was stuff happening. Right. And all of a sudden, there's like five people holding back Manny Ramirez. And the angriest people on the field are the three bench coaches for both the teams.
The 50, 60-year-old men. Yeah.
You know
what?
It's like, I'm part of this.
What did I wonder what they said? Like, I feel like this isn't universally the case, but like, what is the trigger word there that gets those guys the most upset? That's what I'm wondering. You know, like Shane Victorino, you just flick him on the wrong nerve, I think he'll go off in a crazy direction. But like, come on, Davey Lopes, not really a known firebrand. Not even Mariano Duncan is a hothead. Larry Boa is a psychopath. No. But other than that, you know.
Like, I don't – it's not even clear, really. Oh, hold on. Hold on. I'm getting a – so the camera's looking at, you know, Kuroda and Victorino have stopped talking by the time everyone's coming out. Manny – all right, here it is. No, I found it. It's Manny Ramirez was out of the dugout first and started yelling at Davey Lopes. Ah. Davey Lopes is yelling back, and that's what caused the most of it. And then Manny has to be held back from beating up a 65-year-old man.
He wouldn't have touched him. He's not Pedro. He's not
it's
Pedro
like it's like I was just gonna say it's another what was yeah. that Don Zimmer? It's like, oh my God, there are eight people trying to hold back Manny Ramirez from beating up Davey freaking Lopes.
Part of that is let's hold him back, and part of that is. It's Manny Ramirez. If we win this series, it's because of Manny Ramirez. Like, nothing bad can mm-hmm. happen to him. Let's all put our – like, I'm Larry Boa, and I'm – who's this other guy? I'm a guy in a hoodie who's also in the dugout. I will throw my body in front of Manny and take whatever punches or ejections mm-hmm. that you would have issued to him. I will absorb all of them. He might be just the Manny hand. He might be the man handler that's on staff for exactly this purpose. And yeah, this continued because Victorino grounded out on a play where Kuroda was going to cover first, so he was close to first base as Victorino was running back to the dugout, and Victorino of course said some words to him, and that's when the bench is cleared. And yeah, the camera was zooming out, they're going to commercial, they put the score up, and then everybody runs out, and Mariano Duncan's yelling and pointing at Davey Lopes. Davey Lopes is waving dismissively and looking over his shoulder at Mariano Duncan. Yep. You know,
Joe Torre has not said a word through the entire
players
exchange.
Are in the dugouts. Like,
at this point, players are all in the dugout.
One arm of his jacket on, wiping his face off, and
we are watching the same thing right now because it's Because Lopes is still looking back. Like, what's happening? Like, what is
something
this?
Else? Did you say something else? Not worth it. It's the best.
Like, this is my favorite type of Zapruder-ing to do, is like breaking down a brawl when it's not clear what's happening, when there are like 8 different storylines happening at the same time, you know, and like 5 people are having their own little fights with other people, but you have no idea what the central thing was. Why is everyone still out there? Why did everybody run in the first place?
That was the trigger word. It's so interesting. What is that term for stories told from multiple points of view, so you never get the real story?
Oh God, I know what you're talking about. And
I'll just look this up and not make my question part of the podcast, but instead, Rashomon.
I was about to say, is it Rashomon? No, that's something else, isn't it?
I had to Google the terrible movie Vantage Point, which I knew would be described as a Rashomon, to get the answer to that question. So anyway, I would love to get the Rashomon version of this story, the Phillies brawl. But, you know, I'm sure an oral history exists somewhere. This is too paramount of a moment to not have covered very in depth. So that was game 3. Well, I mean, it wasn't game 3 because we didn't really talk about game 3.
I mean, there was baseball too, but
I mean, I guess some other stuff happened, but they lost the game. They lost. The one Phillies loss of the series. They got pounded 7-2. Jamie Moyer, I believe, got the loss. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he didn't even last 2 innings. This was basically a bullpen game for the Phillies. Jamie Moyer got tattooed in the bottom of the first. It was Manny Ramirez again, that third at bat of the game. Killed the Phillies a couple of times, but 3 straight singles led off the game. Manny Ramirez knocked in a run. There was he advanced to second on the throw home. Russell Martin was then hit by a pitch, which, you know, set off all the other events that we were talking about. Casey Blake hit a single. Blake DeWitt came through. This is the one time Blake DeWitt came through in this entire series. He hit a bases clearing triple. That was basically the dagger in this game. So the Dodgers went up 5-0. Rafael Furcal hit a home run. Nomar Garcia-Parra singled in the fourth. And at that point, it was 7-1 because Pedro Feliz had – oh, little Pedro Feliz was like, "Nah, don't worry, guys. I'll shoulder the load." He hit an RBI single in the second. And Pat Burrell hit an RBI single in the seventh to make it 7-2. And that was it. You know, Jonathan Broxton came on in the ninth and shut down the Phillies. So that was the Phillies' one loss in the NLCS. And it was probably the second most memorable game of the series because of all the drama.
Yeah.
But on to game 4, which, Liz, I'm going to let you jump us into game 4 because I know you've got a lot to talk about.
Yeah, this was the game that I actually had the chance to watch on YouTube from beginning to end. I've seen bits and pieces of game 5, but game 4 was the one I'm like, yeah, I'm going to watch game 4 and 5. And I put game 4 on yesterday while I was in the kitchen making dinner. And so I have a notebook and I'm like scrawling notes, you know, and, you know, my notebook has oil and grease all over it from making dinner.
Sure.
Good going, Liz. But yeah, this was Derek Lowe and now I don't even remember who started this game.
Joe Blanton.
Thank you. Joe Blanton, which they just loved. I have lots of little notes scrawled down here about, wow, Joe Blanton, big acquisition. Very important. Buck is trying not to sound like the Phillies are, you know, pathetic Phoebes for having gotten Joe Blanton and not, you know, Manny Ramirez.
Tim McCarver said as this game opened that Derek Lowe's a great control pitcher and Joe Blanton is so wild. So that was going to be the main difference in this game.
He also said something about a butterfly with sore feet. He's like, as they say in golf, it's a butterfly with sore feet. I'm like, you have no idea what the fuck you're talking about.
Have you ever done anything? Are you
like, I'm sure
Earth?
That's a saying and whatever, because all those baseball dudes all play golf. But I'm like, that, what are you even talking about, old man?
I honestly, I'm going to stand up and defend Tim McCarver here. I don't know why the hate was so visceral. Like, he was easy to make fun of.
He was around forever, and he never shut up.
Yeah. Okay, that's true.
It was just the same team, playoff team together for ages. There was no difference and nothing ever got better.
Yeah, but people loved John Madden and Pat Summerall. I think they were trying to establish the new version of that in baseball. And I've never hated Joe Buck as much as some people hate Joe Buck. I think Joe Buck.
I don't really have any feelings about him anymore. I mean, he very obviously does not give a shit about baseball.
Sure.
So.
But a lot of people should give less of a shit about baseball, which is why I found the visceral hatred of McCarver so like hilarious that people cared so much they had to like just quote everything that he said and tear down everything that he said. But you're right. He was disruptively chatty. That's very accurate. And that is.
Well, and my father hates Tim McCarver because he remembers it must have been 80. That the Phillies, I mean, and this was from him, I admit, I think I looked this up once, but not for at least 6 or 7 years, but he told me like the Phillies put him on the roster in 80 to get him a ring. And then he left immediately and spent his entire broadcast career, what my father thought was unfairly and very specifically shitting on the Phillies.
Yeah, but who didn't shit on the Phillies? The Phillies are so bad for such long stretches.
Oh, yeah. That is true. I'm relaying to – listen, we all have stupid reasons. So I grew up hating Tim McCarver, whether or not I even understood why. And when I was old enough, I developed my own reasons why. But
yeah, and I'm not going to sit here and be like, be the chin-scratching at devil's advocate who's like, I just don't understand. I will never understand people's hatred of Tim McCarver. I perfectly understand it. I'm sure I have been vocal about disliking him, but going back to these, it is just kind of, he's just a goofy, folksy guy. Like, he's not worth getting that worked up about, but you're right. There were moments where he was just like, shut up, dude.
Yeah, and I'll admit, listening to him was not unpleasant. I mean, it was because, you know, you heard the ticks and they were fun to make fun of, but, you know, his voice, you could sort of, it was just sort of old man white noise babbling when you didn't want to listen to it.
At this point, it's nostalgic. Like, they've kept Joe Buck in that booth, and Tim McCarver, clearly based on what I said before, that he was in that booth from 93 and 2008 for so long that, like, a generation of people who have been watching baseball have grown up, and now just hearing their voices is, like, throws you back the way that hearing Joe Buck reminds you of playoff baseball or, like, primetime football games. Like, it's too late to not be reminded of that. You will, if you don't already, you will have a soft spot for Joe Buck because it will just be in your brain that he is those moments. He is like nice, crisp, brisk fall afternoons on Sunday where you're watching the game with your dad. Like, that'll just be what pops into your head. So it happens to everybody. And McCarver, you know, he's no exception, I think.
Yeah. And at least, listen, Tim McCarver has a relatively pleasant voice. He never sounds, I'm trying to think of the word. He always sounds very posed and composed. He was a decent broadcaster, regardless of whatever, you know, the stuff that I liked or didn't like that came out of his face. But I mean, I like having listened to that and John Smoltz so recently, in 10 years, we'll be like, oh, John Smoltz, please kill me if I ever
that. No, I don't think John Smoltz has long term of a shelf life. I don't think he's going to install himself in anybody's mind. As special.
He's a little more honest, a little less scripted, which I do appreciate. You could tell that he's not trying, sometimes he's trying to be diplomatic, but, you know, he's really coming from the game, you know, from his perspective, you know, and he, as a person, he's different than Tim McCarver. I can't say I like it. I don't like it. he doesn't have a good broadcast voice and it bothers me a lot. I think maybe I'm just looking for, you know, broadcaster white noise, and so they need to have a decent voice for that. I just don't like the way Smoltz sounds or the things that he says or who he is.
For his face, his entire person, his family, anyone who knows his family, you know, stuff like that.
Yeah, all of it.
I'm with you. I think we could give it a shot where there's people in the booth who like baseball. I think that'd be worth it, you know? Get Tim Kirkjian in there. I'm a big Tim Kirkjian fan. Get him in the booth. He lives for baseball.
Baseball needs its own version of Tony Romo.
Oh, yeah.
Just
what a disgusting thought, but true.
I know. I mean, but here's the thing. Since he stopped being on the Cowboys, I don't care. Like, he's good. I mean, he's not polished. He's certainly more now than he was. But he's not – he was so good last year. He was interesting, and he was so excited – about everything. Like, I loved that. That's why I really enjoyed listening to him. And there's no one who does that for baseball.
Who is?
Though I do. Go ahead.
Who is baseball's Tony Romo? Here's the first name that popped into my head. Jabba Chamberlain.
Talking about. Wow.
You know, somebody who went to a high profile team, got super covered, but never won anything really, right? Did he ever, was he ever won one, any of those? No, he never won a ring.
Ooh, wow. I don't know.
Oh, wait, he was on the 2009 Yankees. Sorry, he doesn't have a little ring next to him on the next to 2009 on Baseball Reference. So, mm-hmm. Okay, so that's incorrect, but that's the first name that popped into my mind. Somebody who was on a high profile team, tons of coverage, but never actually won anything and got hurt a lot.
Yeah, that's true. I'm trying to. Yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yes, I'm sorry, I scoffed. I wanted to take a minute and talk about this is sort of a little bit on the Tony Romo, who's baseball's. I was thinking about who could be baseball's Tony Romo announcer. But I recently had an idea that Mike Trout, or every network should have asked Mike Trout to come to their studio and give weather reports for the stadium.
Oh God, yeah, he's done it before, right? He's been one of the guys they bring in to just sit in the studio and talk. Sometimes they'll have current players do that. Hasn't he done that?
Sometimes they haven't really done that this year, and I don't know why. Maybe it's just that they've stopped doing it for current players. They only want former players. But I'm really. Like, that would give him something to do where it's of his interest. It's kind of fun and quirky.
Show him to the country.
Yes. Like, put him on Fox and let him do, like, they already, Fox has, is it Pedro? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Fox has Pedro and David Ortiz. Like, honestly, have them throw to him and give a weather report. Have them all come over and interact with him. Like, a big stadium weather thing. You know, have him explain weather stuff. He loves weather stuff. Like, give him something to do that's fun and interesting that aligns with his, you know, aligns with what he likes. And I think that's such a great idea. Why no one take my idea? I don't care.
Liz, you nailed that. Take it. That's a really good idea. He should, yeah. If anybody, he should be there. I remember seeing him in like a winter coat, breathing cold air, and that certainly wasn't while he was playing on the Angels, because they're never playing this time of year, but it must have been because he was in a position like that. And yeah, just have him do the weather. That's so quirky and fun. No, do it.
My guess is that someone was interviewing him at an Angels game. I was just gonna say, like, the only time I see Mike Trout outside in cold weather is the Eagles games that he goes to. He went to see the Eagles before the end of the baseball season, because there was an off day on Monday. And so after the game, he flew, or whenever, I don't remember, it must have been the Monday night game. He flew after Sunday to hit a Monday game, to hit the Monday night game. And then went back and played baseball the next day.
Person. But if you were Mike Trout,
he continues to be Eagles fan. Everybody knows,
not just baseball player, but sports fan. It's incredibly endearing, and we wish him the best in his current struggle, which is, of course, being a member of the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim. So,
or as I said, soon it will be the Los Angeles Angels of Austin
of Philadelphia
or Belinda.
Yes. Well, in game four.
All right, there's still more game four. Sorry, we got real distracted. That's why I tune in.
Oh, you weren't talking to me, were you? You were talking to the listeners. Hello, listeners.
Okay, so game four, Derek Lowe does not have a good. I think he either gave up a hit or something like that real early. And yes, he gave up two runs early. Goes back to the dugout and has a little boy temper tantrum.
Oh, and a Rich Hill temper tantrum.
Yes, only somehow less endearing. Like he's throwing a bunch of crap. He ripped his jersey off.
Oh, dude, when you start going on the jersey, that's where you lose me. Like, that's like, okay, you're not that mad, or your anger is drug assisted. Like, give me a break.
Like he attacked a Gatorade thing, got everything wet.
Oh, my anger can't be constrained in clothes. Oh, I'm just like, being Grapple Hawk out here. Oh! Like, give me a break. That's not real.
Yeah, I don't understand. It was so, so childish. Shut up, Derek Lowe. You suck then, you suck now.
A real low point. I know. I said it before, but I'm just making sure. Making sure everyone heard.
Making sure everyone heard you the first time.
Yes. But yeah, he gave up. He gave up an RBI double to Chase Utley. He even let Ryan Howard hit an RBI ground out.
And yeah.
Yeah, that was brutal. James Loney came back and smacked an RBI double off Bland the next inning, so it was 2-1. But yeah, did not have a great game, Derek Lowe. I mean, he didn't give up any more runs before they took him out, but they took him out at the end of the fifth, so they really didn't. They weren't really excited about what else he would have to offer. Then, of course, Liz. Manny strikes in the fifth.
Well, before this, before Manny struck in the fifth, in the first inning, the Phillies intentionally walked him with one out and one on in the first inning. Charlie Manuel told Joe Blanton to walk Manny Ramirez.
Charlie Manuel sent the hand signal to his pitcher, the hand signal for fuck this, and they just sent Manny Ramirez to first base, which utterly flummoxed Joe Buck and Tim McCarver.
Oh, so confused.
Yeah, so mad. Like, there was a runner, now there's a runner on base, and now Russell Martin was the go-ahead run at the plate. It's only the first inning, though. Like, they were like, but it's only the first inning. I'm like, but that's why he's doing it. And I mean, if you can avoid Manny, especially 2008 Manny, then you just avoid him. Because it may be cowardly, but it gives you a good chance of keeping runs off the board, more so than pitching to him. I mean, it's a sign of respect at that point. And in that being said, James Loney crushes an almost homer that knocked in a run. Joe Bland's 0-2 fastball didn't get the job done with two outs. And Victorino managed to barehand it and got the ball in so fast the Dodgers couldn't score more than once. But still, I mean, I don't hate that idea as much as Buck and McCarver did.
No, I mean, yeah, it still seems weird. It's the first time that they faced him, but he had caused so much damage. I think they just wanted to take the bat out of his hands and maybe not put so much pressure on Joe, old Joe, early on.
They were really talking up. This was definitely an old school angled broadcast, I would say, because they were really talking up Juan Pierre, who was on the Dodgers at the time, calling him a tough player.
I have written down year two of a 5-year deal.
They said he's, quote, drenched in sweat before most guys get to the park. But they didn't cite any statistics. They just said that kind of stuff about him.
He works hard.
Because they were saying this because the Dodgers at the time had a lot of young outfield options. Matt Kemp was 10 years younger than he is today.
Looks the same.
Looks exactly the same. Yeah. But yeah, that they were saying Juan Pierre may not have a role moving forward. But they were talking him up, doing his agent's work for him. You know, he gets to the park early. What if the worse you got at baseball, the older you got, the earlier you came to the ballpark in hopes that would trick people for a little while that you were like, well, he's been here the whole time. He must be good. Give him 5 years.
Yeah, future Philly Juan Pierre.
And that's hilarious because they tried to do a hit and run with the pitcher batting in this inning as well. And Pierre is thrown out. Because
because
Derek Lowe like swung and missed, and Juan Pierre's thrown out at second, which is hilarious because it wasn't the end of the inning, and Derek Lowe floated a single to center on the next pitch. One pitch late for that hit and run, Derek Lowe just not looking down at the third base coach fast enough.
No, not quite. I love Juan Pierre. I've always loved him and his old timey puffy baseball pants.
Yeah. How long was he on the Phillies?
Like a year.
Yeah, it was not.
Maybe.
It might have been 2012 only. Yeah, that was. Yeah. Yeah, those were dark days. But remember, some of the players the Phillies acquired in that era had been good elsewhere many years before. So exactly. To them, it wasn't dark days. To them, was, I'm getting played to suck until I retire. This is great. Yeah. Well, Bear wasn't really sucking yet at that point, but he sucked on that play. And speaking of third base coaches, Larry Bowa apparently couldn't stay in the coaching. He had ants in his pants, could not stay in the coaching box for the Dodgers.
No.
To the point that the umpires had to make a point to tell him to get in it, which again, they're never in those boxes, right? They're always just leaping out of them. Maybe you're allowed to be outside of them during a play or something, but they're never just contained to those boxes, which tells you either that the rules were different or Larry Bowa was so dramatically far out of the box that they were like, Larry, you can't stand on the pitcher's mound and coach their face. You got to get in the box.
I think it's partially that. I think he was being egregious, or he was being he was out and being very obvious about it, really hand wavy. I think that they've started enforcing those rules more often, because I recall that maybe recently that they were talking about, you know, they were enforcing those rules about where they can stand more. And I think maybe they have to stay in them before and during a play, and then after a play is over, they can move up. Like, as you see, you know, you see the coaches come and talk to the players, you know, once they're on base and all that. But yeah, my bet is that he probably was being normal, you know, not being normal. That's Larry Bowa. But I think he was a normal distance from the box, but he was just being very animated about it and just like, hello, I'm over here. Look at me.
Well, it's interesting, because then the Dodgers broke off a couple of runs in the fifth inning. Well, of course, a Manny Ramirez single. Man, it is boring to cover these games. It is the same thing. Manny knocks in runs. But on that play where Rafael Furcal was rounding third, he actually ran through a stop sign that Larry Bowa was throwing up, because he managed to score because Pat Burrell, get this, missed the cutoff man. And Larry Bowa is throwing up a stop sign and comes within maybe one follicle of a hair of touching Rafael Furcal to stop him as he rounded third, which may have also been a reason that the umpires were like, hey, get back in there. The Dodgers in the fifth inning, they wound up scoring twice, I believe, and the Phillies went behind 3-2. So, yeah, but not no thanks to Larry Boa's coaching strategies. And this, like you said, this is when Clayton Kershaw came on in relief, actually, pitched to Ryan Howard to start the sixth.
Yeah, a little age looks good on him. he legitimately looks like he looks like a baddie. That's a super good question. Hold on. I have the entire roster of the 2008. Delwyn Young, there's a name.
Ew, no, there's not. I think there's a Delwyn Young in my vents, actually. I gotta wrap him out with a broomstick. Get out of there, Delwyn. What are you doing in there?
He was 20.
Clayton Kershaw was.
He was 20 years
old.
Yeah,
that sounds about right.
Wow.
20-year-old Clayton Kershaw coming on relief, walking Ryan Howard, which is not easy to do back then.
No.
And then allowing a single to Pat Burrell, and then Shane Victorino bunts. He's sack bunts Howard over to third and Burrell to second. So Kershaw leaves the game having allowed two runners to reach scoring position, which is not what the Dodgers wanted for certain. But then it was Carlos Ruiz. The only way the Phillies scored was Chan Ho Park came in and threw a wild pitch, allowing Howard to score on a wild pitch. Ryan Howard scored running home on a wild pitch.
Remember those days?
That happened.
Remember
when Ryan Howard had a fully intact leg and foot muscles? That was a wild time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then after that, Dodgers scored again the next inning. I mean, this was probably the most back and forth game of the series, I would say. This most similar to last night's ALCS game. So in the bottom of the sixth, Casey Blake facing Chad Durbin leads off with a home run. Furcal again reaches on an error, which is great. He's the recipient of an error and not the committer of one. That must have been a relief in his mind. It was Ryan Howard throwing error, which, by the way, you know, get used to those, Philadelphia. Get used to those, 2008 Philadelphia. The seventh was quiet, but then it all happened in the eighth, because that's around the time Joe Buck said the magic words that should be heaven on earth for every Phillies fan. Broxton is getting loose for the Dodgers in the pen.
Yes. Yes. I mean, he came in. I watched this 15 seconds ago, and I don't remember who he replaced.
Corey
Chandler Park.
He actually, this was something that I wanted to point out. I'm sorry to cut you off, but Corey Wade actually came in first, and it was Corey Wade
who
allowed the Shane
you.
Victorino home run.
Yes. After that home run, in the dugout, Victorino has so much adrenaline inside of him, he looks enraged. His eyes are narrowed and his face is all, he's like taking off his batting gloves with angry face. And I'm like, wow.
Well, I'll tell you what, this was in game five. I have this written down for, but I'd like to say it now because it's appropriate.
Please.
So in game five, the man they were calling Kenny Rosenthal on the broadcast, I guess because he was 12 years old at the time.
with his full-size ties.
Told us that the Phillies do a good job of policing themselves because one of them printed out a picture of Victorino with his hand raised in the air after the grand slam in the NLDS when he was rounding the bases with his hand up, put it on his locker with the caption, Shades of Reyes. yeah. What is that? What the hell is that? They're mad at him for being excited. First of all, it's Victorino. Yep. He's excited because the sun came up in the morning. Secondly, it's the playoffs and you're like burning him like that. And Joe Buck asks him, and did Victorino get the message? Like that was a universally like, oh yeah, that's reviled behavior. Hopefully he got the message not to do that anymore. I mean, we've had enough conversations about how utterly stupid it is to for players' celebrations to be quelled to the point that it is now Major League Baseball's marketing concept for the 2018 mm-hmm. playoffs to deride people who think that people shouldn't celebrate and be excited while they play baseball. Well, I mean, that was just like, man, you're gonna do that to Shane? If Shane's not excited, then he's asleep and he can't play baseball while he's asleep, idiot.
A decade ago, it wasn't a question, though. I mean, that's why this has been so difficult for people to grasp, that watching these games and watching the playoffs now, I tweeted about it a few days ago, how really bizarre it is to watch the difference. Like, the celebrations are muted, much more reserved. It's like they're like Victorino getting that on his locker wasn't thought of as bad or wrong at the time. That it was common around baseball. Celebrations were not, they weren't done the way they are now. And I don't think the Phillies were unique in doing that.
I don't think
weren't.
So either. I mean, that's why Rosenthal was able to be like, oh, they police themselves. Like that was what policing a locker room was quashing any sort of over exuberance like that, or showing the other team up, blah, 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 the right way, blah, blah, blah. Can you imagine Odubel Herrera pointing at where he thinks the pitch was in an era like that, even just 10 years ago? My God, he would have been, Charlie Manuel would have yanked him out of a game. So how many times would Charlie Manuel have yanked Odubel Herrera out of a game, like over the course of the last few years?
Yeah.
So many times.
So much. Like, and I want to say, it's not that it's like, I think baseball today is better and more interesting than it was a decade ago, but I'm looking at it in fullness of time. 10 years ago, it was fine and I loved it and everybody loved it. That's how it was. You know, I don't want to judge yesterday, at least for something as inconsequential in the long run. You know, judge baseball of yesterday by today's celebration standards. You know, this isn't hazing, it's celebration. It is sort of the quashing of someone's self-expression, but it's how things were done. Baseball has like traversed, you know, a huge, you know, a giant world of stuff in less than a generation. You know, for now, Major League Baseball's marketing is "Let the kids play" with Ken Griffey Jr. narrating the commercial.
I was saying that to my friend. Where the hell's he been as far as marketing goes? Like, who do you think's watching baseball right now, other than, you know, the median age is being like 56? People our age, that's baseball. Where the get him off the bench? Where the hell's he been?
I said to my fiance last night, it looks like Ken Griffey Jr. ate the 21-year-old version of himself.
Yeah, but that hat still looks good, though, man.
He does, and I'm not saying I'm not trying to make fun of his appearance. He's certainly not, you know, out of shape or obese. He's huge. His arms are the size of a thigh. He's enormous. He ate the 21-year-old version of himself, and it just distributed itself all around his body. It's insane.
My first ever nickname was Griffey, not because I was good, because I was not, but because I just always wore my hat backwards, and they just called me Griffey or Griff, which was like, I was bracing myself for much worse nicknames.
That's so cool.
From athletes, but they called me that because, just because I wore my hat backwards. And it probably was a sick burn of some kind because I was not at all good. So that I now realize after considering this for a minute, this was a much worse insult than an actual insult. Well, in any case, I didn't play in this game, thank God. And the Dodgers, what the hell happened? The Phillies won. This is the huge game that we came here to talk about.
It's okay. People have been waiting for this. We're talking about the NLCS. It's huge. You'll all keep listening.
Liz, take us through the drama
The magic was Matt Stairs coming to the plate with a runner on and, having an at bat with Jonathan Broxton, and the words just issued forth from Joe Buck, one of probably the best calls he's ever made. This one, I think it was, he also did a really great call, one of the recent World Series, 13-14, a Rangers something. But he opened his mouth. He just said, "Stairs, rips one into the night," like he'd been waiting to say it. It's inspired. Broadcasters have those moments, and it doesn't get any better from a guy like Joe Buck, who does this, for a living and has the opportunity to call a lot of franchise defining moments, which certainly that one was for the Phillies in a lot of ways. It's just the best moment. Stairs rips one into the night. The home run goes. Everyone in the dugout allows themselves to get excited a little bit. Not too publicly. They wait until Stairs gets back into the dugout before accosting him. I think it's Jeff Jenkins is, right behind Charlie Manuel, who's at his perch on the, over the railing on the right next to the dugout stairs. He puts his hands on Charlie's hips and shakes.
He gives him a very familial home run, or a very familial hug, which is super into. And Jenkins was probably the biggest cheerleader in that dugout. Just based on what you see all throughout the season, he was one of the more excited guys openly. And part of that probably was just I'm happy to still be here. Supposed to be his job. He was supposed to be the starting right fielder that Worth eventually became. But Howard's really excited. Everybody, they allowed themselves to show some emotion. And as Matt Stairs eloquently put it in the post-game press conference, it's great, going down there and guys start hammering your ass. And it's the moment he lives for as a baseball player. coming through for his team like that. He knows why he's on the team. He's like, "Hi, I'm the giant blunt instrument that you use to hit the baseball 500 feet. And if I don't do that, then crap." But he was in there to hit a home run because Victorino got to Wade after Brian Howard led off with a single. And then Victorino hit a two-run home run that tied the game at 5. And then Matt Stairs came in after Carlos Ruiz had singled. And he was the first batter that Broxton was facing, and he worked a 5-pitch at bat, and then he bashed that home run that won the game. That was what he was on the team for. And that's honestly, we say Joe Bland, those are the guys who make the difference. And that's true that Pat Gillick acquired guys, not the Manny Ramirez's, but the smaller pieces that played key roles. He couldn't have predicted Joe Blanton hitting a home run in a World Series and stuff like that, that happened after he had acquired those players, those smaller role players. But that Matt Stairs hitting that home run, you can make an argument is one of the biggest success stories of a free agent's a trade deadline acquisition, because that's exactly what Pat Gillick imagined when he acquired Matt Stairs. That moment.
Yeah,
exactly. That's
he fulfilled his mm-hmm. ultimate purpose as a baseball player in that situation in that year. He could have done nothing else for the Phillies but that, and it would have been worth whatever they gave up, because he helped them win that game. And winning that game, you don't know what would have happened. They still had more games to play after if they had lost, but you have no idea what happens.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, they had tied the game, but you don't know. You really don't know what happened. Then the playoff series the momentum shifts at the drop of a hat. And they were still in LA, and they still had another game to play in LA. So, that was a huge moment, and you could write probably a whole book just on that moment and all the stuff, like all the things that culminated in. Like that was huge. That was, I think John Stolness called it the biggest home run in Phillies history, or at least, you know, submitted the idea that it was. And I'm sure there were certainly other ones that people suggested, but I mean, damn, like
that has to be, I mean, that's, I would argue, you know, if we're talking about just home runs, not necessarily walk-offs, you know, for as far as historical implications, that's, it's got to be in the top five, if not like top three.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I'm not even, I'm saying that without even really knowing what I'm considering the other two to be. So in my head,
I was going to say top three, and I thought you're being hasty. You can't even think of anything else other than this home run right now.
That's fair. But if somebody asked me on a regular basis, I'm very confident. Like, what was the best home run in Phillies history? That one would be the first one come to mind.
Yeah.
You know, and we are probably biased in considering home runs from this era specifically. So the other one that comes to mind is Howard's home run in the 2011 NLDS. Like, that was just a great home run.
That one just came to my mind. Yes. Oh, you thought of the same one I did, and I just realized that a series before, didn't Victorino hit a grand slam?
Victorino's grand slam, obviously.
You know, and then in 2009, there was Chooch against Broxton, too.
Yeah. That's right.
It'll be fun to talk about all of that. In a year from now, we'll be talking about Carlos Ruiz and Jimmy Rollins.
We'll see you back here then, when we're doing that. But yes, let's finish. We're in the home stretch here. So Broxton.
Yes,
Jonathan Broxton hadn't given up a home run since July 2006. He had been over 2 years since he had given up a home run, and then Matt Stairs showed up. And Joe Torre said that this was such an emotional loss that he didn't have his team come to the park the next day, which I guess was like an off day, or he didn't have them come in like before the game. He like didn't set a time for them to come in and like, you know, do warm-up stuff. He just kind of was like, everybody go home and just try to mentally climb over this.
You know, that's actually more than I expected of Joe Torre, I guess. You know, I know a little bit about him as a manager, but that seems like more emotionally intelligent than I would give him credit for being. So, you know, I would also say, like, I guess it was an emotional loss, but I mean, they had separated themselves by enough runs, I think. No, it was still a relatively close game. And so, like, I guess emotional loss, it's not like you lost in the bottom of the ninth.
Right. Phillies won by 2 runs based on that big inning with Victorino and Stairs' home runs. And the Dodgers had been up by 2 runs for only 1 inning. But they had kept battling, and it had been something of a back-and-forth battle, and they were at home in their own stadium. And, you know, they had won the previous night. So it was, you know, they lost late. They lost late with their big closer on the mound, the guy that's supposed to be able to hold the game in that situation. They were asking him to get 6 outs, and he blew it immediately. Immediately. So, yeah, that's emotional. That's gutting.
Yeah.
Then game five, Liz. David Boreanaz read the Phillies lineup for the broadcast, and Henry Winkler read for the Dodgers with that Henry Winkler rules. Like
Emmy Award winner for the first time in his, you know, 50-plus year career on television and in movies. That would be Henry Winkler, Emmy Award winner.
I'm sorry that he had to watch the Dodgers lose this game and lose this that night. But he had has a twinkle in his eye at any moment, and you're just like, I hope things work out for you, Henry Winkler. But I know in this game, in the context of this baseball game,
you will be sad.
They do not. But Joe Buck called the Dodgers an old school Dodger crew because they showed up late to this game, which is some spin.
Meaningless.
Spin that can send you into the next universe.
Like, wow. That's it. No, that's not.
Yeah.
None of that is true or works or means what he thinks it means.
Joe Buck, who does hate baseball, was probably madder than anyone that anybody showed up late, let alone one of the teams, since that's going to hold the game from being over sooner.
Old school Dodger crew. Yes, they're an old school Dodger crew in that they are emotionally devastated by the loss they gave up the night before. Like, is that what you're saying?
They're trying to stifle negative emotion. That's pretty old school. Just shove it down and act like everything's normal.
No, but that would be coming on time while, you know, silently crying and pretending everything is fine.
Well, they stuck a mic on Shane Victorino, which is terrifying. I mean, I get the idea, but you're really open yourself up there. But honestly, the footage I saw from them doing that, he's just mumbling to the bench coach, Jimmy Williams, and you cannot understand what he's saying.
So, I think he also wore a mic during Game 5 of the World Series, at least the second part. Sure.
He's the most...
Because I just...
He was one of the most entertaining players on the team. They're going to stick on any producer's going to be like, Victorino, get the mic on him. Yes. What are they going to do? Stick it on Chase and just have like glowering silence the entire game?
Yeah. Yeah. I just remember seeing footage of Victorino running in from the outfield and actually hearing him cheer into a microphone.
Yeah, you're right.
Like hearing him actually cheer up close. And I'm like, wow, they had him wearing a microphone right then. I wonder what happened after he got crushed. Oh no, he didn't get crushed. He jumped on top. We'll be breaking down the World Series dog pile. Yeah. We'll be breaking it down extensively.
But yeah, this was Chad Billingsley was tasked by the Dodgers to save the series. You know, the guy who'd given up 2 4-run innings to the Phillies just a couple of games ago. Billingsley had been, quote, not good at all in game 2, according to the broadcast. And it does not go well for Chad as Jimmy Rollins leads off with a home run, which is not the start the Dodgers wanted. And who cares? That was exactly what everybody in Philadelphia needed to see. Like, all right, we're taking it home. We're ready to finish this.
Oh, God. When you look up Chad Billingsley, he's staring back at you in a Phillies uniform. Oh,
come on, man. That's right. I forgot he was.
I had totally forgot.
He was model one of the Charlie Morton experience. And
both, oh, God, you're
both
right.
Both of which ending in tragedy.
I mean, this was actually past the time that they were picking up reclamation projects. So he was on the Phillies in 2015 after not pitching in 2014. I think they acquired Harang around this time or before, and they had done AJ Burnett the year before too.
Love it. What about Jerome Williams? Remember that?
In a decade, in what, 5 years when we start covering these shitty years? Will we end the podcast? Is my next question.
And then they sucked again. The end. No, we're not doing that. It's ridiculous.
Stay tuned for 5 or 6 years from
Don't.
Now. When we figure out what we're doing.
Do not stay tuned. I will not either. Well, Liz, something I think happens in every Major League Baseball playoff series is exactly what we've talked about in this series with different contexts. There's varying degrees of this. Jason Wirth had quite the takeout slide on Rafael Furcal during a double play in the first inning, solidifying my theory that this happens every year. And they talked about it. Hopped back up and he was like, yeah, I think the trainer came out and poked around at him a little bit, but that was that's a debate. It feels like every year the Utley rule was a milestone because a guy like had to be carted off the field with a broken leg. So they were like, okay. And this year is also different because it looks like I'm positive Manny Machado kicked Jesus Aguilar in the leg on purpose. Like that's totally a different situation. He also did have some takeout slides, some of which, involved grabbing with his hands the player, which again, I don't want to get into this, but I will say for the next time when we do get into this, I think Manny Machado wants to be classified as he just plays the game hard. He wants that because I'm sure he does, but he's not good at it yet. He's not good at hiding the fact that he's trying to hurt people because he is. If you're reaching out to grab at the player, we can see that. We have eyeballs. You're not hiding anything.
It's like, well, and that's kind of the thing. It's like there's a difference between Chase Utley and Manny Machado because there's playing the game hard and playing the game to hurt and or for an advantage that is an obvious advantage. You know, Utley was able to – whether he was doing it, I don't think he was ever doing it to hurt. It's all part of, you know, his version of playing the game hard, which is the version that a lot of players from that era subscribed to. And fewer do today. But Craig Counsell had a quote where he was talking about it and he said, I don't think Manny's playing the game very hard. I don't think he's, you know, playing very hard. I'm like, that's, you don't have to say anything else about Manny right now other than that, because when you do that type of stuff, it's usually that you're not playing hard because everyone is noticing that you're doing it.
Yeah. And that's kind of the interesting intersection here that we're talking about Manny Machado because of the slides and because of kicking Jesus Aguilar and because of his quote about not you know, hustling. And like, that's where the comparisons to players who are playing hard kind of end, because a player who's playing hard is hustling. Correct me if I'm wrong. Like somebody who's true. Like, oh, he just plays the game the right way. That they say that because he's not someone who's like, I don't hustle. I'm not saying I disagree with Manny. I think you and I are in the same side of the argument when it comes to the hustle argument. We both love Dave Roberts' response to that. That it was like, yeah, you know, look, but mm-hmm. look at his numbers, man. If you want to criticize him for not hustling, fine. But if you're not going to put him on your team for not hustling, then you're not putting those numbers on your team, and that's asinine. But some of this other stuff is more like, why are you trying to hurt everyone? Like, this is
why are you trying to hurt everyone?
Yeah, so
like, if he had made those comments about Johnny Hustle and all that stuff, which is, you know, which again I have no problem with, because it's just being honest. Like, yeah, I'm a human. Like, yeah, I'm getting paid a lot of money to do this, but I'm like anybody else. I don't always want to run it out completely. You know, I'm a person, and Dave Roberts agreeing with that is great. But then he just did a whole bunch of other stuff that made him look even worse. Like, the comments weren't going to be taken right by anybody. I think the comments on their own wasn't going to push any GM off from picking him up or whatever it is. It wasn't going to make anybody inside the game who mattered question. This stuff is what I feel like probably will make, like, I have no inside information, but I feel like this is the stuff that will make people question. It will make people lowball him, which makes him less likely to sign with, you know, certain teams like the Yankees, for example. They play pretty clean these days. They're not the Yankees they once were. Like, there's some old school about them, but I don't think it's that type of old school where they're like trying to trip a player as you go by a bag, like,
or just hurt him, you know, like break something. I don't know if he had like ruptured an Achilles or something on that play. We're talking, I don't know. It seems like a different conversation. You know, the fact that they like seem to work it out. Okay, fine. But like, that won't be the last time that Manny Machado does something like that.
No.
And that's
And you mentioned before in our Slack, he has a history of bad behavior. And I think that he hasn't really been in the spotlight like this before. And he may not really know what to do, because he doesn't have the same Orioles team around him as he did that I think would protect him in this way. And he doesn't have the age argument on his side anymore either, because it's been years. Like, he's been in the
protect
majors for a long
by
time.
By sucking
now.
Enough that they're not a part of the national conversation on baseball. Yes, that is the insulation Manny Machado received. So this game in 2008 turned into a bullpen game for the Dodgers, but not on purpose. They threw seven pitchers, including Greg Maddux, who I mentioned before. I believe he's the only player to appear in both the series we are discussing on this podcast. He's the only one to play in both 1993 and 2008. That has to be true, right?
I can't imagine that it's not. Like, I'm looking at the names of the dudes on the Dodgers, and it's all, you know, like, Andrew Jones was not around in 1993. Casey Blake, Nomar. Like, dudes I have not heard. Pablo Ozuna, remember that? I remember nothing about him other than his name. Like, AJ Ellis was 27. He wasn't around. Like, Derek Lowe was 35 then.
Wow. Wasn't he pitching, like, this year?
5 years ago. I believe he's on the upcoming Hall of Fame ballot. But he, like, I had no idea. Wow. Hiroki Kuroda was 33, and he pitched for at least another 3-4 years after that.
It's incredible that Maddux was in this game. I really totally forgot about that entirely. And that there's anyone who played in both of these series is incredible. It just blows my mind. And so with Maddux pitching,
that was his last, by the way. That pitching outing was probably the last one of his entire career.
That makes total sense.
It absolutely was, because the Dodgers were eliminated in 08 was his very last year.
Yeah. So J-Roll steals in the third. to start a rally. He gets his left hand around the tag, and this it looks like he's out in real time, but they slow it down, and the ump gets the call right. Obviously, there wasn't replay back then, and he managed to get around the tag perfectly with his left hand, which was beautiful. He was so good at that. Having a player on you, that's such a niche skill, and when you're good at it, it's so crucial to be able to get around a tag like that, to know where you're going to go, to like precision sliding. That is such a, that's so cool. So with a full count to Utley with two outs, Dodgers fans on their feet, Utley draws a walk and shuts him up. And Ryan Howard was at this point in the regular season, he had averaged a home run every 12.7 at bats. And he was cool because he had been pretty, he had been pretty cold. So with two strikes, Howard rips a breaking ball for a single. Breaking ball, a pitch he cannot hit for a single through the shift.
So it was an it was an accident then.
Yeah.
All those things you say mean accident.
They scored a run. Pat Burrell followed with a deep single that I think clattered off the fence to make it 3-0. And at this point, Tim McCarver was still talking about Rollins' steal because the slide was so huge. And like that, that makes perfect sense. And I mentioned that this was now a bullpen game for the Dodgers. Their offense didn't help them much at all. In the second inning, Blake DeWitt had grounded into an inning-ending double play. He had left 13 runners in scoring position on base by himself during the NLCS. Russell Martin had left 12. Matt Kemp had left 10. There was a bunch of guys who had all left 6. This was a sizable problem for the Dodgers. Jimmy and Ryan weren't doing much better. They had left 9 and 8 runners in scoring position respectively, but you know, they were on a team where other people were managing to come through. And 13 is a huge number for one guy in one series to leave in scoring position. I mean, the Dodgers were setting the table, and their table clearer was Blake DeWitt, and he was just not going to come through, unfortunately. So a little league play in the fifth led to more Phillies runs with two runners on. Burrell grounded a short, but Furcal kicked the shit out of the ball, and Utley raced home from second to score. Throw home was so off, it landed far enough away that Ryan Howard, again, advanced to third, and Burrell to second, which, again, Burrell advanced. Two errors on one play. Then they walked Victorino on purpose. Pedro Veliz strikes out. And then the ball is hit back to Furcal by Chooch, who fucks it up again by throwing super low to first base.
How many more years is Furcal in the league? Let's take a look.
I don't know. He had a tremendous season, I believe. He had a terrible series, but like a great 2008, I think. If I remember looking at the numbers correctly.
He did have a great 2008. No gold glove, notably. 357. This was far. 357 batting average. Is that what?
This is the only year he had an OPS over 1,000. This was his best year at the plate. He was 30 years old.
It's because he played 36 games.
Ah, yes.
He was out for most of the year with a bat. Yes, I remember hearing about this in game 4. He was out for most of the year with a back issue. And when he came back, they played him all the time. They played him right away and straight through the playoffs too. They just sort of went with him. No gold glove that year or any year. Not a gold glover.
Well, on that
he retired in 2014. I just wanted to say that.
That's wow. That's much later than you would have guessed. Mm-hmm. So on that throw, James Loney catches the ball and chucks it home, and they actually had Pat Burrell caught between bases on that throw. They caught him between second and third, and then the throw sails over Russell Martin's head. Ugh. And it was just a fucking mess out there. The Dodgers fans were booing.
Oh, I mean, that's a nightmare.
Yeah, it's brutal
to watch. Is it like we've watched that? We've watched everything fall apart in front of our faces. It's even worse when it happens in the playoffs, and it's so egregious and embarrassing. Because unlike a regular, you know, one of the 162, you know, the fans of your team and probably the other team are watching.
Yeah.
In the playoffs, it's the entire country. Everyone is watching, and it's the only baseball happening, and it's the biggest baseball story the next day. Like, wow, that's so embarrassing and bad. And I feel bad in retrospect for all those fans, but not bad enough that I want anything to change.
I don't know if anybody had a worse NLCS game 5 than Furcal. His leg gets jacked up on the Jason Wirth slide in the first. He commits two errors in one inning that both resulted in runs, and he went 0-for-4 at the plate. Like, that's a big reason they lost this game. When you have a guy like that just black-holing your lineup and your defense, like getting hurt, like, oh my god, that sucks for him. Well, Manny, of course, tagged Cole Hamels with a solo shot, but that was it. Ryan Madsen and Brad Lidge pitched around the blips of trouble leading to a Nomar Garciaparra foul out that sent the Phillies to the World Series. So that was the 2008 NLCS in a nutshell, in a 90-minute nutshell.
How could we have not spent a whole bunch of time talking about this, though? It's a fun and awesome series.
Oh,
so much
agree.
Cool stuff happened. Like,
totally agree, yeah. And I didn't even mention the Duracell commercial I saw about a child tracker that it features a kid named Kevin. He disappears in the park, and there's the mom's looking around, and there's this montage of panicked shots, one of which is of a white van driving away. Like, Duracell going full dark on the child tracker. Like, I don't know. Is she kidding that van? You don't know. Duracell, child tracker. Messed up.
Buy a child tracker or sacrifice your child to kidnappers.
Anytime you see a van, your kid could be in there. You don't know. Child tracker, Duracell. Yeah. And the kid who's like 12 years old comes back holding a red balloon and smiling. And you're like, what is this family?
Why like a red balloon at 12? Like at 12, that's an 8, 7 or 6 year old thing to wander off and be like balloon.
maybe got it from the van, who knows.
Also, there was an iPhone 3G commercial.
Those were
the iPhone 3G, which is tiny. tiny and features a version of at bat with like an anemic video game baseball player guy in Game Day. Like, you know, they have the baseball dude standing with the bat depending on which side the batter, you know, bats with, and like they had it, he looked like the air had been let out of him. Like, it's so low rent and very, you know, very sort of early iPhone.
Revolutionary technology. Yeah, that was...
At the time, the little pitch dots just appeared. So that, yeah, the iPhone commercial I saw was like, look at Game Day. You can have all this information right on your phone.
What are you, an idiot? Get a tiny iPhone.
Tiny iPhone. It's so small. I'm just like, how can you see anything on here?
Well, even with the app running, you probably couldn't because it was all so primitive.
Yes.
Well... In any case, this has been your latest episode of Continued Success. We got through the entire 2008 NLCS. Next episode, we'll finish up the 93 NLCS, which we inexplicably separated into two episodes. And then it's on to the World Series for your enjoyment. And if we got to stretch that into a couple episodes because there's a lot we want to talk about, then we'll do that too. And you get to keep listening into the offseason. But until then, keep listening to Continued Success every week and subscribe and download our podcasts that are all a part of the Good Fight podcast family, including Hittin' Season with John Stolness and The Dirty Inning with myself and Trevor Strunk. It's all good stuff. And don't forget to subscribe to our Patreon. You'll get access to John's weekly newsletter. You get access to Philly's history. You get access to all kinds of bonus Dirty Innings. Continued Success After Dark, which Liz and I will start doing soon. Where if you think we're, you know, stifled and filtered on this podcast, then wait until
we each have a couple of drinks in
us. Get ready, hold on to your hats, ladies and gentlemen. But thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoyed going down memory lane with the 2008 NLCS with us. We certainly had a good time talking about it, and it's only going to get funner, folks. So keep listening, and we'll talk to you next time on Continued Success.
I'm Michael Kist of Bleeding Green Nation, and I invite you, gentle listener, to join us for the best analysis of the Super Bowl champion Philadelphia Eagles in the business. BGN Radio provides you with the most informative preview shows, and the Kist and Solak show dives deep into all the scheme and X and O details you could ever want. Plus discussions with the industry's brightest minds, including former NFL players, and press conferences from the Eagles coaching staff to keep you up to date and informed every step of the way. Subscribe to Bleeding Green Nation today. Fly, Eagles, fly.